Welcome back to another edition of Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I'm, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites. That's coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow all of our brands on Twitter. That's at coach_AD, at train condition, at winning hoops, and then myself, as always, if you like, at Wesley Sykes _. And today we welcome to the program Angelo Gingerelli, assistant strength and conditioning coordinator at Seton Hall University. And he is the author of the new book, Finish Strong, Resistance Training for Endurance Athletes, available anywhere books are sold. I believe it just came out in late November, November 30th of 2021. So thanks for taking the time to join us here, Angelo. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks so much for having me on. I've been reading training conditioning since the mid-2000s, so 10-plus years. And I've written articles for you guys before, which is really great. But super excited to be on a podcast today, man, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm excited to talk about the book here, too, because, you know, as I like to say this on the podcast, I am a very novice runner, very novice endurance athlete here as a weekend warrior type. So I'm hoping to take a little bit from our conversation, maybe apply it into my own life in a little bit of way here. But I think a good place to start is tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe a little background information, and then what inspired you to write this book. Once again, Finish Strong, Resistance Training for Endurance Athletes.
Oh, awesome, man. So I grew up at the Jersey Shore. I went to a public high school as a strength and conditioning coach, very rare, even today, but in the 90s, even more rare, and just got super lucky, and he was a big influence on my life. Decided I wanted to do that, went to University of Delaware for undergrad, majored in exercise science, and with a concentration in strength and conditioning, which is a brand new thing in the late 90s. Graduated from University of Delaware. I was a GA for 2 years at Virginia Tech. Mike Gentry was a former guest on the show a couple weeks ago. I got to work with him down at Virginia Tech in the early 2000s. It was a great experience. And then from there, my first job was at North Carolina State. A couple years there to a season with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Then I got hired at Seton Hall in 2005 and have been there ever since. So, yeah, anybody listening to the show knows in the strength and conditioning, athletic training field, you know, 5-6 years is a long time in one place. Going on 20 is almost unheard of. I'm a unicorn out there. But I was in a weird thing, man. I grew up a Seton Hall fan. I got a Seton Hall starter jacket when I was a kid. My whole family's in the New Jersey area. I get to live at the Jersey Shore now and work at a place I grew up being a fan of. And, you know, if you can align that many things in a row, why not stay there and make the best life for yourself you can in that area? So over the course of the past 17 years, I've fallen into a good group. I'm on campus every day. I'm working in the weight room with all 250 of our student athletes. I teach a couple classes every semester. And then just being a part of the academic community led me to meet Dr. RJ Borders. He's an athletic trainer with a PhD in teacher and athletic training program. And when he came to campus about 10 years ago, we just hit it off. We were running together, lifting together. We just became friends real quick. Mm-hmm. And then in 2018, we had a conversation on one of our long runs. Like, we were one of the few endurance athletes we knew, that both of us, that liked to run, but also realized the value of lifting weights, right? Mm-hmm. And we would run together on Monday. Then we might lift together on Tuesday, run again on Wednesday, whatever the training pattern might be. And then we were talking about our friends and our colleagues, but really they were in one camp or the other, right? And my background is in Olympic lifting and power lifting. And running was such on the other side of that spectrum, right? As I got older, I just got into running and really liked it. And you said you're a weekend warrior yourself, which I think is pretty cool because marathoning, triathlon athletes, the swimmers, that's the kind of thing you can get better at as you get older, right? Mm-hmm. It's really hard to be a better baseball player at 35 than you were at 25. But you could jump into the endurance world at 25, 35, 45 years old and see real progress, right? And that's when me and Dr. Borders got together. We were like, you know, we're both close to 40 at the time, and we're still getting faster. We're still getting better. We're still feeling better about ourselves as opposed to seeing that constant decline of the human body we see so often as people get to middle age. And we think at least part of that is adding that resistance training component to our endurance training, right? Mm-hmm. And then that got the ball rolling, and then the book came out. It was delayed a few times because of COVID, but it was a 3-year process. And we dropped at the end of 2021, and it's been really cool, man. It's been super well received by both the endurance sports and sports medicine communities, and I think we're putting some good information out there. I think it came out at the right time too, because people can get it. They might have gotten it as a Christmas gift or picked it up for themselves around the holidays. And now is the time to implement new stuff, right? The new, everybody makes fun of New Year's resolution people,
right?
That by, you know, Valentine's Day don't go to the gym anymore. But yeah, if you're an incredibly active person, you're a competitive athlete, January is the perfect time to try some new things, right? Because your bigger races are probably in the spring and summer. So now's the time to throw some new stuff in the training program, see if your body reacts to it, and decide what's going to be a part of your plan moving forward. So I think that New Year's resolution can be a good thing. We don't have to point and laugh at those people all the time, right?
Yeah, and what I loved about it too, and just kind of seeing the breakdown in the table of contents, is that when you get to that back end, that back third of the book, you know, it seems like you have a really nice, easy breakdown. The top 10 exercises for a bicyclist, top 10 exercises for, you know, a swimmer, a runner. And then I think even it goes for, you know, a little bit further about how different workout templates and different guides that you can kind of implement in your own workout too. So, you know, after taking the information that you learned from those first two thirds, you know, you can kind of start to apply it in that back third there.
Yeah, we're in a kind of a weird time. I always say, I think in the 2020s, late 2010s, lifting weights and endurance athletes were where lifting weights and baseball players were in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody kind of knows you have to do it. It makes sense on paper why you would do it, but people are still real confused about how to implement it and make it work in reality, right? So if you look at, you know, baseball guys in the 80s, where the idea was out there to lift weights, but people thought you'd be a bodybuilder, you wouldn't be able to swing anymore, you'd lose your timing on the ball. By the 90s, they kind of figured it out, right? And that you see that. And now, obviously, even though steroids were obviously a factor for a lot of those players, we can't ignore the elephant in the room. But you can't say, in addition to steroids, proper weight training, proper lifting really made a difference for your McGuire's, your Sosa's, your Barry Bonds. How you feel about them, whether cheaters or not, Hall of Fame, that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
But the training definitely caught up to the talent in the game, and it got better. And I really think this decade, that's where we are with our endurance athletes. And the players and the runners, swimmers, and cyclists that figure it out first, if they're already very talented, they're going to be the ones who really separate themselves from the pack, the way the baseball guys that adopted lifting in the 80s really separated themselves from the rest of the players in the 90s. So I think we make a joke a lot, and we have a cross-country team at CNO. We don't have a full track program anymore. But from someone who's been around track a lot of my life, we do this. Track coaches tend to do this thing, and no hate at all, but everything we do on the track is meticulously planned, right? Rest intervals are timed out to the second. What stretches we're doing, how fast we're running this 400, that 400. And then at the end of that, you'll hear him say, all right, now go to the weight room, with no guidance beyond that whatsoever, right? So we decided, let's take that go to the weight room mentality and give these people what to do, right? Give our readers an exact template or a recipe to follow. That if we're not, and we're not saying we've cracked the code or it's the greatest program ever, but if you're starting and if you're a runner, a cycler, triathlete, or a cyclist or triathlete, this is going to be some stuff you can add to your program that we think will see a benefit from right away, right? Because we kind of hit on early on in our talks about the book where I think any endurance athletes listening or any athletic trainer to deal with that endurance athletes will agree on. Endurance athletes by nature have two things going on. They have too much fatigue from covering so many miles, yards, meters, however you want to calculate it, and you have so little time because by nature, the sport takes a lot of time, right? Mm-hmm. If you run 18 miles in a day, how much more time that do you have to train? So we kind of took it from the approach of everybody's pre-fatigued, everybody's short on time. How can we give you the best bang for your buck, right? And then I'm a big advocate of, as a 20-year strength and conditioning coach, unless you're hurting yourself, like causing traumatic injury to yourself while you're doing the exercise, I don't really think there's good and bad exercises, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's situations that make an exercise a good or a bad choice. So what we did with the top 10 list and our core six foundation exercises were, if you only have, let's say, 2 30- to 45-minute sessions per week where you could be in the gym, here's where we think you're going to get the best bang per minute and get the most out of that time in the gym, because we know you're stressed. And then you got racing, you got training runs, you got swims, you got kids to pick up, you got a job. So we're going to try to give you the most, make the most of that time in the weight room and not ask you to go in there for 2 hours when we know by nature of the sport and by nature of just American life, you probably don't have another 2 hours laying around to spend in the gym.
Right. Right. Yeah. I love that there. And you know, when you think about training, you know, endurance athletes, I think the first thing that kind of comes to mind is legs. You want to have strong legs. But I think the core and the trunk strength is equally as important, if not more important there. You know, what are some ways that you can, you know, help endurance athletes build that core and trunk strength?
A perfect question, man. And I think here's one thing. It's kind of a joke, but kind of true. If you go take a picture of anybody at the start of a race, from a 5K to an ultra marathon, everybody looks good at the starting line, right? Mm-hmm. Shoulders are pulled back, chest is tall, we're breathing good, we're feeling good, we're running proud, right? For lack of a better term, good biomechanics. Go get that camera out at the finish line, and everybody's broken down, right? No, stride length is shorter, knee high is not coming up as high, yeah. Breathing's a mess, shoulders are hunched forward, right? So our idea is kind of like you said with that core and trunk stuff, how do we maintain good biomechanics for the course of a race? How do we make mile 26 look the same to the naked eye as mile one? And that's how we're really going to be better and improve our performance by being able to repeat that first mile, you know, let's say 25 more miles in a row if we're running a marathon, 2 more miles in a row if it's a 5K and you're new to this. But the idea is that can we keep the core and our posture muscles as strong as possible over the long haul, right? So you get the traditional old school ab exercise, your sit-ups, your leg raises, your crunches. That stuff's good, right? There's a place for it. Can we throw some med ball work in there and make it a little more ballistic? Can we do some isometric holds, some bridging, some planking, some stuff like that that's really going to mimic how you have to hold your body in a good position over the course of maybe a several-hour endurance event, and that might be even better. So we kind of came at it from the perspective of, yes, core is incredibly important. Does everybody want a six-pack to look good on the beach and take their shirt off at the end on the trophy platform? Absolutely. That's right. The thing. You should train for that. If you're going to take your shirt off at the end of a race, have some abs to show people. Cool. But can we look at some other things with rotation, anti-rotation movements, and some isometric holds that might be a little bit better for actual propelling our body from the start line to the finish line?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, and then getting back to that leg work, you know, when you're talking about these endurance athletes, how much do you prioritize that leg work over, say, upper body work in the weight room? You know, how important, or maybe like in another way, how important is upper body work to endurance athletes?
It's a delicate balance between the two, right? Mm-hmm. We need strong legs, but we don't need to be squatting the whole squat rack every time we're in there, right? We need a reasonably strong upper body, but not putting 3 plates on the bar before we bench press, right? Yeah, it's kind of a give and take and a risk versus reward kind of thing. And what I always say is, to some extent, it's kind of good to look at your training and play to your strengths. What I mean by that is, if you know you're doing a long run on a Sunday, to ask yourself to squat and deadlift heavy on Monday is foolish. Your body's not going to be able to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Can you make that Monday an upper body day and get some hypertrophy, some strength on your pecs, your lats, your biceps, triceps, shoulders, and then maybe recover and then come back on Wednesday or Thursday and hit some squats, some lunges, some step-ups, and really build some strength in your legs? Well, that's a possibility, right? I think a lot of times people look at training for an event as, I have to run, 400 miles in 3 months or whatever it is, and I'm going to be doing this much. But I think it's overwhelming. But then you break it down to a week, and as you go through it and steadily increase that miles, think about how your body feels. There's times in a week you can plug some strength training in and make some real gains if you do it properly and you think about it and plan it out ahead of time. That's part of what we're trying to do with the book, is give people a template to plan it out ahead of time. Another thing we did, which I think is valuable, if you're in the, I know a lot of your listeners are in the scholastic sports world, right? Where it's very clear, let's say if it's a high school football team, your preseason is July and August, your season is September till November, your off season might be December and January, and then maybe we're doing off season training February to the end of the school year or something like that. Endurance athletes are in a weird place because if we're not talking about high school cross country or college cross country, there's no real training calendar, right? Like, you can decide to sign up for a marathon in January and then an open water swim in July and a cycling event in November. And then it's kind of up to you to figure out that training. So what we kind of did is ask people to pick their A event, their big events of the year, and plan their training around that the way you would a high school cross country season or college swimming season or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then realize that there's times of the year where you're not going to want to be sore because your mileage and your pace and your times are really important. There's other times here you can try new things, and if it beats you up the next day, it's not that big a deal because that's the time you're experimenting with new things. So we kind of ask people to identify 4 main phases of the year and make their training work that way. The same way I've been doing for decades with our college athletes, where I meet with coaches early on in the year and we say, all right, these are the most important events. This is when we can train and beat them up a little bit. This is when we got to pull it back, give them some recovery time. And I think I would say, it's a little soapbox I have, in America, in the social media era, but even before that, just the mass media era of the last 50 years, and we're so obsessed with giving it all every day, walking off the field physically, mentally, emotionally exhausted, all the Rocky type movies, right? Where someone's cheating and bloody, clearly concussed and still fighting. I love Rocky, watch the next guy. But we never see an Instagram post of LeBron James taking a nap. We don't see Steph Curry eating a good protein, high fiber meal to recover for the next day. I think we got to prioritize that a little bit more if we really want to see long-term progress, because any athletic trainer that deals with a cross-country team will know it's a literal, it's a daily marathon and a months-long marathon that season, even with the young high school kids. And the idea of my idea is if we start training for something, we should feel better at the end of that training period than we did before, right? Mm-hmm. If you train for over 3 months, and I just see so many of these distance athletes from the high school to the adult level finish just being just depleted and worn down and emaciated. And can you do some things to make it a good experience? I like to train. I like to run marathons. I don't like to feel terrible. I don't like to feel like I need a month off after I do a race. So I think we researched and put together and wrote some good ways to avoid that and feel good the next day after an event and feel like you want to go do the next one.
Yeah, and I think that segues nicely into my next question here about, again, the fatigue and the rest and the recovery factor of all this. I think you talk a lot about, and I feel like a couple of chapters are devoted to this in your book, is flexibility, mobility, pliability. And I think one of the sections is actually called Movement is the Medicine there. So I was wondering if you can just kind of maybe go into the thought process behind that a little bit and how that can, having long, lengthy, lean muscles can prolong your athletic career.
Sure. Just full disclosure, that chapter was written mainly by Dr. Borders. He's an athletic trainer. He dealt with mainly the sports medicine side of the book. I dealt with more the actual training and exercise prescription part. But in general, we feel the same way about it. I'm sure we'd say the same thing. We're at a point in human history where our daily lives require so little movement, right? Like right now, we're having a great time having this conversation, but I'm in a chair, you're in a chair, we're here for at least an hour. Right. Our ancestors didn't sit down midday for an hour and speak to each other ever. They were, way back, they were hunting, fishing, gathering. Even 100 years ago, everything was so physical, right? And then the old cliche is that, kids don't go outside and play anymore. They play organized sports or they play Xbox. There's no in the middle anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think then one of the collateral damage of that, while there's great things about the internet and phones and, Nintendo Switches, I love all that stuff.
Sure.
But some of the bad side of it is, if you're always sitting and always reinforcing poor posture and letting our muscles get progressively tighter and weaker because we're sitting down so much, whether it's the car, the computer, the video game console, whatever it is, we can't expect to jump up after sitting down for 8 hours and go off perfect biomechanics, perfect movement patterns on everything we've done when we barely, even if you're an avid runner and you run an hour a day, the other 23 hours a day, unless you have a physical job, are probably pretty sedentary, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to get people back to normal movement patterns, good posture, good biomechanics, good ranges of motion. And the really sad thing is I always say, I'm lucky in that at the college level, I deal with the cream of the crop, right? We're in the Big East, we're in a big conference. Any kid I deal with was the best blank baseball, basketball player, whatever it is, at their high school, maybe their town, okay? These kids don't move well a lot of the times, right? They can't bend over and touch their toes. They can't do a squat without their heels coming off the ground. They can't lunge and keep their torso upright. So then if that's the best, what are the other high school kids looking like, right?
Right.
So and it's an eye, when you look at it that way, it's really an eye-opening, it's an epidemic, if you will, of people that move poorly. And if you're 8 to 17, I would say if you're 17, 18 years old and your body doesn't work right, you're young enough and your metabolism is fast enough where you're going to not care. You're not going to be forced to care. Mm-hmm. If you don't address that when you're young, be 35, be 40, be 50 years old. And now your back hurts every time you get out of bed. Your Achilles hurts every time you go up and down steps. And now you become overweight because you didn't exercise and address the problem. And now you're out of breath going to get the mail, right? Okay. And I think it becomes a quality of life issue where for all of the great technological advances we've made in the last 50 years, I'm the biggest fan of technology out there. We're better at stuff. We can check our email anytime we want. We get text messages from friends anytime we want. We know what's going on anywhere in the world at the touch of a finger. But are we giving up something on the health end of it because of that? And I think too often we are. So I think there's a balance. I always say, be on Instagram, but go for a run too. They're both good things.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think about this when I go to the gym sometimes too, and kind of going to your point of how you opened up 100 years ago. We were doing physical things just to get through the day to day of everyday life, right? But now life is so sedentary that you need to go spend an hour on the hamster wheel treadmill to kind of get that energy out that you would normally be spending to, just do your daily activities. So sometimes I kind of have a little laugh about that when, again, when I'm getting to the gym, but I think it's necessary to kind of get that physical inertia out, you know, not even just from a physical aspect, but from a mental health standpoint. I mean, just to keep the sanity from the day to day. Cause again, it does kind of get, you know, monotonous, you know, on a daily level.
Yeah. I'm an advocate of like basically a moderation diet. I think carbs are good in moderation. Protein's right. good in moderation. But I think in the last 10 years, the popularity of like the keto diet, a carnivore diet, the caveman diet, there's an interesting thing that those people that are really big proponents of that don't acknowledge, which is you could eat an entire side of beef when you spent all day chasing down the animal before you ate it.
Right.
You know what I mean? But if you go to the super, you drive through a supermarket and buy it and then drive home and cook it, do you need 3,000 calories of pork loin in one sitting? Probably not. Yeah. It's just the way we live. And I would say, you said the hamster wheel, the treadmill. I've been playing around with this idea in my mind a lot. I think in our profession, guys like us that like to train, we look at people that don't like to train, we look down on them a lot, right? They're fat, they're slobs, they should take care of themselves. They don't, you know, to some extent, you can make the argument we're all paying for them the way we pay for our health insurance because they don't want to put the work in. And as I got older, I kind of look at it like, if you look at human evolution, the idea of every generation up until probably our grandparents was their only daily activity was to find enough calories to stay alive and procreate and have children, right? Your whole existence was getting calories to stay alive. We're only about three generations into having too many calories, right? So I think biologically, a lot of people are still on the idea of I have to consume as many calories as possible just to keep myself alive. Like every other animal on earth besides humans, that's their daily directive, right?
Right.
Eat and procreate. And we're the only species that have kind of gotten beyond that. And I think that like the running on a treadmill is brutal because probably the least thing your animal side of your mind wants to do is burn calories for no reason, right? Right. We've never, till about 100 years ago, that would be the most foreign concept possible to a human being. Why would I ever do that? And now because of the way we're eating and the way we're living, we kind of have to jump on that hamster wheel, like you said, which is not ideal, but it's a very odd time we're living in. We're like the technology and the agricultural industrial complex has progressed so much in such a short period of time, and our biology just hasn't.
Yeah, no, it's interesting too. And again, like the idea of going to the gym and just lifting up big things for an hour, you know, heavy things for an hour is just kind of, you know, a weird concept. But again, I think it's great for your overall mental health and what we were just talking about there. But what are some exercises? We touched on this a little bit in our earlier conversation here, but about the different exercises that bicyclists, endurance athletes, different things can do. So what are some examples of that? I think you mentioned some of the core before, but outside of the core.
So what we did early on in the book is we identified six foundation exercises that we think pretty much everybody could benefit from, right? And they're just their common motor patterns. It's a squat, a lunge, a hip hinge, an upper body push, an upper body pull, and a hip bridge, right? And then we give you a bunch of variations on those. But let's keep it real. A barbell squat is a great idea for everybody in theory. There's certain people, their body's not going to let them do that, right? Mm-hmm. Can we do it with a med ball? Can we do it with a dumbbell? Can we do it with a kettlebell? Can we use a machine in some cases that's similar to a squat that lets that person get through that range of motion? Yeah. So we're trying to think about all the different variations we can use. And then we built our program around implementing those six foundation exercises or core motor patterns. And then we gave for each subset of endurance athlete our top 10 exercises, right? And I'm looking at that as I understand if you're a cyclist, you could probably get something out of the running exercises, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a swimmer, you could pull something out of the cycling workout and get something good out of it. But if you're dealing with that too little time, too much fatigue, and you only do three exercises in the gym, in our opinion, these are the top three you should pick if you're a dedicated dedicated cyclist. So we kind of broke it down as get some of these core, these foundation movements in every day, pick one, two, or three of your sport-specific exercises, and then hit some core, and then maybe a stretch, and then go on with your day after that. But I think that if you can do those six things in a weight room, pretty good. If you can squat, you can lunge, you can hip hinge, you can hip bridge, and you can pull and push with your upper body, that gives you a great foundation, right? Mm-hmm. And then from there, you can kind of pick how you want to build on that foundation with your more sport-specific stuff. Like, for example, any swimmers are listening, and I've been dealing with college swimmers for 20 years, one of my favorite teams here at Seton Hall, but like, they're doing that swimming motion so many thousands of times a day, right? Maybe a million times in the course of a four-year career. Am I going to ask that guy or girl to press a heavy dumbbell over their head? No, that's kind of foolish, right? Can we get that delt stabilization another way? Can we put a little less resistance on and move their body differently where we're helping what's going on in the pool and not potentially injuring them, yeah, I think that's a definite way to do that, right? So right. The sport-specific stuff, I think about being smart about the demands of the sport, addressing the demands of the sport, and not just crushing the muscles and motor patterns they're already overtraining by participating in the sport.
I love that. I love that here. And again, as we wrap things up here, we touched on this a little bit earlier in our conversation, kind of talking about the rigors of the college athlete, the college student athlete. But you know, how do you prepare athletes maybe for the mental and physical rigors, you know, of college athletics? I feel like a couple episodes, maybe this is going back a couple months now, but we had Ken Sales, who was a pretty established high school running coach at Capistrano High School in California. I believe his book is Coach, Run, and Win. That's out now. But he was discussing, again, just how much miles you run on a regular basis for your just training at the college level and how you have to ramp up to that. And that sometimes can burn out, an incoming freshman, both mentally and physically, before they can really get their feet under them, so to speak.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, and this is going from, definitely if you come from a smaller high school setting, but even if you're at a top level high school, right, where everything you've done athletically is to prepare those kids to go to the next level. There's high schools like that out there, obviously. I mean, the biggest thing strength coaches, sport coaches, parents, and players can do is research what you're going to be expected of them at the next level and start preparing for that almost as early as you can, right? So say, for example, in the running example, if your high school cross-country coach have you run 25 miles a week and you, through whatever means, figure out that when you go to college, that coach is looking for 50 to 60 miles a week, I would be building to that entire summer before you get on campus, right? We live in a good time where a lot of this stuff is online. And I always say, if you commit to a college, contact the strength coach immediately. Give them an email, give them a call. Find out what's being expected today to get there. And it sounds like a joke, but I'm dead serious about this. I've said this at NCAA presentations before. If you can't get in touch with the strength coach or the college you committed 4 years of your life to, you picked the wrong college, okay? Mm-hmm. That guy or girl is there to help you get through the next 4 years and maximize your athletic potential. They should be able to sit down with you. No one's too busy to do this. If I was too busy becoming a freshman, I got to go look for another job. So I like to tell people off top, this is what's expected, right? So, for example, one of our best teams is Seton Hall. Our baseball team has been a near dynasty for the last 20 years. And I tell our recruits on the day I meet them, when they're juniors for 15 years, I'm like, here's what we do. It's cold. We play in the cold. It's where we are in North Jersey, right? Mm-hmm. We're up 3 mornings a week minimum lifting weights at either 6 or 7 a.m., okay? You're never going to be allowed to miss class. We're not going to make any concessions for you to miss any of this stuff. And I'm going to be incredibly hard on you every time I see you in the weight room or if we're doing conditioning on the field, right? And then if they want more information, I'll go, okay, we do this kind of conditioning. These are our main lifts in the weight room, so they can start getting ready for it before they get there. I feel like one thing in college athletics is people come on the campus either after a break or as freshmen, and they're blindsided by what's happening there. And I can't stand the back in my day, kids today are soft. I hate that argument. But what I will say is, if we give you the information of what's going to be expected and you choose not to prepare for that, that's your fault, right? Mm-hmm. But if you have the information and you come in as ready as you can, you give yourself a much better chance for success and having a good career than if you start behind the eight ball on day one, which unfortunately a lot of kids do. But there's really no reason for it anymore, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, because I think every strength coach that I've talked to on this program and just through the time that I've had this job, I mean, they've all said to a man that they spend the most time with the student athletes. So if you can't get in touch with the strength coach, they're oftentimes there more often than, say, your head coach or maybe different offensive coordinator, whatever team that you're on. But I'm thinking maybe more so from a football perspective too here. But those strength and conditioning coaches are there in the weight room with you, like you said, 3-4 times a week at least.
Yeah, if you look at NCAA rules and who's allowed to be around the players the most from a strictly mathematics standpoint, hours wise, it's the strength and conditioning coaches, right? And then I always say, there's two things I love about college strength and conditioning. And one of the reasons why I left the Pittsburgh Pirates to pursue this, besides being a rabid Seton Hall fan my whole life, yesterday I was in the waiting room for 12 hours. I was there from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. That's not unusual at all for a college strength coach, right? Mm-hmm. But every hour for 12 hours, I was doing something totally different. At 7 a.m., I had softball. Great group, does a great job. at 7 a.m. We had right after them, I think it was baseball. Different, completely different vibe, different music, different lifts, different type of training. Later in the day, we had cross country, completely different, right? Then I teach a class midday. I get to do something different. And one of the best things about this profession is you get to be around so many different kind of kids, so many different kind of athletes, and really develop your toolbox of developing better kinds of training, right? Whereas in my opinion, if you just decide very early on in your career, I'm a basketball strength coach, I'm a football strength coach, you really are going to spend your entire career pigeonholed into that box. And that might work for you. That might be a great box to be in for you. I like the idea of doing something different every couple hours or every hour and kind of seeing different populations. And in my opinion, getting better at training different populations. One thing I think our profession on definitely the strength and conditioning side and maybe the athletic training side too, we don't know enough or do enough for distance athletes, in my opinion. And I didn't realize that until I ran a marathon for myself 10 years ago. I was the typical, you know, quote unquote, meathead powerlifting strength coach that everybody had to lift, and the cross country kids didn't like to train, and they just came in with dirty sneakers from the trail and wrecked the weight room and were paying everybody's neck, right? then I ran a marathon, and I was like, oh, wait, it's real hard to go run 10 miles on hills and come in and do squats and RDLs. So maybe we got to make some concessions and train this a little bit differently. But I do think one thing, it was an incredibly eye-opening experience, right? And then I really, it changed the next 10 years of my career. It allowed me to write this book we're talking about, and it made me an inarguably better strength coach, right? And then that's one thing strength coaches could get a little better at. Of like, we keep professing it's a life, training is a lifelong passion, right? You got to stay fit your whole life and keep training your whole life. Don't be scared to try new things. You know, I went from powerlifting, which is the most anaerobic opposite of endurance training sport there is, to being a massive fan and a super, I think, big part of New Jersey endurance running community. And it's been a great experience, and I got better at my job because of it. I think, like, you know, we're real, as a sweeping generalization, we see something like CrossFit and shut it down. We see something like, I don't like kettlebells. I don't like Macy's. That's a fad. It might be a fad, but you might like it now. So I think, you have some principles and have some philosophies of training, but also for me personally, just opening up those philosophies a little bit has really led to like a second phase of my career that's been really fun and enjoyable and hopefully helping some people out with this book.
I love that. I love that. Great. Here, so before I like to let you go, I like to do this with all my guests here. It's called a little segment called Five Questions that have nothing to do with sports. So kind of put you on the spot, a little bit of a lightning round question here. So what do you think? You're up for it real quick? Right. You got the time?
Let's go. Let's do it.
Well, you said before we started recording here that you're a lifelong New Jerseyan. So I need to know, as a resident, do you believe in the New Jersey Devil?
No, I think what probably happened was some people saw an animal, maybe it was dusk or dawn, and little, not great visibility down in the Pine Barrens, and they made a mistake with some other kind of regular animal they thought was a monster. I don't think it's a real thing.
Yeah, it would be what, some sort of like a Tasmanian devil? Is that kind of like what it would be, like a Wolverine?
The picture of it I've seen, it seems like a mix between like a Wolverine and a kangaroo almost.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't think that exists. It just doesn't seem like it's a feasible thing.
Yeah, it's a nice little piece of lore here, So Massachusetts, we have something called the Bridgewater Triangle, which apparently is all this crazy, paranormal activity has gone on there. But I like that. Maybe New Jersey Devil went up to the Bridgewater Triangle.
Possible. I just fell in.
Yeah. Recent news here. I don't know if you're a big fan of Wordle, but Wordle was bought out by the New York Times here. This craze has been sweeping the internet. Do you partake in Wordle? And do you have a stand on whether you should share your scores on social media?
I hate to admit this because I think I said I like the internet five times in our conversation. I don't know what it is. What is Wordle? Is it like a Words with Friends type
it's
game?
New, it's fairly new. I just found out about this like a couple weeks ago. But it's this website that you go to and it's a word game. You have to guess five-letter words. And if a letter pops up green, then you have to get all five letters green to create the word. So it's almost like a word search, word guessing game.
Okay.
But it's swept all of the internet, where it just fills up my timeline, everyone posting their Wordle scores. But the guy who made it, apparently it was just one guy. It's kind of an interesting story. He wanted to do it to impress his wife, who was a big fan of word searches and that sort of thing. And now like millions upon millions of people have used it, and it's become too much for him to operate. So he sold it to the New York Times for like seven figures.
Okay, number one, congrats to him. That's
phenomenal. Yeah, right? That's pretty
good,
awesome.
Good for him. I say post it, man. If you're killing the Wordle game and you're putting up something new, people got to aspire to be as good as you, go ahead and do it. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, set the bar. I like that. I'm in Massachusetts or New Jersey. I'm sure you just went through a snowstorm recently. What do you need? What are some must-haves in your household for a snowstorm?
Okay, good question. I'll make it easy for you, man. I'm gonna give the most New Jersey answer ever. I'm digging out my driveway immediately so I can order pizza.
Oh yeah, I like that. Okay, so where do you stand? So I'm imagining you're a fan of, you know, a classic New York slice, kind of thin crust style pizza. What do you think about all this, the Chicago deep dish pizza, this Detroit style pizza, all that stuff?
Okay, I look at it like, I'm trying to think. Like, say if you have I'm a big sneaker guy, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a favorite pair of Jordans, let's say you love Jordan 5s, but you can also respect the 6s, 7s, and 8s because they're good too, they're just not your favorite. That's where I look at other kinds of pizza. Like, I'm a New Jersey, New York pizza guy, but if you tell me you like Chicago or Detroit or, you know, Hawaiian pineapple and ham on your pizza. Yep. I'm not going to tell you you're right, but I'm not going to fight with you either. There's more than enough kinds of pizza out there. We can all be happy. And, I could like the Yankees. You could like the Red Sox. And still be friends.
Yeah. See, okay. I like that here, man. You should be running for office here. Put down the weights. Yeah. But speaking of strength coaches, what is a strength coach's preferred music to work out to? That's what I like to know.
Okay. I'm in the way minority of strength coaches on this, but I am a lifelong 30 years in hip hop head. And that's me. If I'm in the weight room by myself, it's probably a little bit older, like, you know, 90s, Jay-Z, Nas, Wu-Tang hip hop.
Sure.
One of the best things about our job is you stay current and know what the kids are listening to. Right. Yep. So I always joke around like I'm in my 40s, my daughter's 6, and she'll be like, did you hear this new Drake song? Did you hear this new Little Baby song? I'm like, man, I heard that before you. We had that on the way your mom last week. She's like, why do you know about this? Like, because I'm around 18-year-old kids all day. But yeah, man, I think hip hop's great, and the new stuff is, I can't stand a back in my day conversation.
Right.
So that's my view on that. Just stay current and like whatever's out there. There's a lot of good music out there now.
I love, there was a time in my life, probably in college, where I could say I was knee deep in the rap game. I loved every mixtape, old school Jay-Z, early Kanye West, Lil Wayne mixtapes, all that stuff, 50 Cent, all that stuff, you know? But now as I've gotten older, I'm probably more ankle deep into it. But again, this new age rap stuff, I want to say get off my lawn, be the old man back in my day type of thing.
Right.
But I'm trying to avoid that too. So I've grown to like some of the newer stuff.
Yeah, man, I think that's good. I always say people that get stuck in whatever era of music, movies, video games, like, how many times can you listen to the same thing?
Exactly.
Like, I'm the biggest Biggie Smalls fan there ever was, but he only had 2 albums. How many times can I listen to him? I got to move on to something else at some point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I have no problem with the new stuff at all.
I love it. Well, Angelo, thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time out to speak with us today. Once again, the book is Finish Strong, Resistance Training for Endurance Athletes. So it's, once again, available anywhere books are sold. Where can the people get in touch with you if you'd like, Angelo?
Great. The best email to reach me for stuff like this is just angelo.gingerelli@gmail.com. Send any questions you have. If you want more info on the book, it's on Amazon. That's probably the best place to read the reviews and see the table of contents and see what's in there. And then on Instagram, we're at finish_strong_book. We try to put, so we don't want to use that just as strictly, it's not just every day another commercial for the book. We're trying to put some content on there, some tips on there. As race season starts picking up, as we hit the spring here, we're going to be posting about some of the good races in New Jersey and around the country. So it's at finish_strong_book for content about the book and just resistance training for endurance athletes in general.
All right. And you can once again follow all of our brands on Twitter. So that's @coach_AD, @traincondition, @winninghoops. And then myself, as always, if you like, that's @WesleySykes_. And you want to follow those counts to get a first look at who our next guest will be. But until then, sports fans, my name is Wesley Sykes. And thank you for listening to another edition of Sideline Sessions. And thank you, Angelo.
That was great, man. Thank you very much.